This is Arthur Coleman and Pilar Montero. January 11th, 2013. Up from Scapegoating: Archetypal Theory with Examples from Human Sacrifice in the Andes.
So Pilar will talk about the human sacrifice in the Andes, actually sacrifice. And I'll start with an example, the general theory and lots of stories about scapegoating. Scapegoating is a very dark subject. I found myself putting on black. And so the stories are in part to make it, can't say it's fun, but at least enliven it. So Pilar will be talking about the Andes part of the work. This is a lecture and hopefully questions. And I guess if it's a small enough group, so if people are moved to have questions while we're talking, that's okay, you know, within limits. And but afterwards we'll have questions. And then tomorrow, for those of you who want to come back for the workshop, Pilar and I have really done workshops on the process of scapegoating, the experiential process all over the world, and I'll begin this lecture talking about South Africa. So if anybody is, I hope you'll come, and if you come, it can be more material, or we can move more into experiential work. And if anyone comes and has a drum, bring it. So that's just an appetizer. Okay. So I will put on glasses so I can see. Tom Wilkinson invited me. I assume it's from the group. He said that it was a very important subject, and I agree. I think it's a critical subject, scapegoating. And I also received several emails from people in the Seattle area questioning whether I was going to be serious about this, or I'm just going to talk about the politics of America or something like that, which has scapegoating in it. And I think there's an intuition that, as the person who introduced us, that this is in the culture, and it's been in the culture forever. It's just that it's gotten out of hand, and I'll get back to that. But first I want to tell you about an adventure that Pilar and I had. We were asked to talk to in South Africa on scapegoating. And we were asked by a group like this, and we were also asked by industry, because that apartheid was a big scapegoating horror. And we came a few years after that was over, and they needed help. The government corporations needed help in how to integrate people into the culture. It's still going on. And one of the perks was we were allowed or told or given a free trip to a game park in South Africa. So there was rain. And they said, well, why don't you go north in Africa and come back in a week and a half? So we did. We took a plane and we went up to Nairobi and went to various places. We still had a week left. And someone said, why not go to Rwanda and see the gorillas? So we got on a plane and we went to Rwanda to see the gorillas, and we were met by a very tall, very handsome African man, black man, and he said, well, that's all set up for the gorillas, but would you like to see the memorials? And Pilar and I looked at each other and realized that we had arrived in this place where the most powerful genocide had ever happened in the world. In how many have been to Rwanda? Just so I know. Okay. Well, films and news, you know, Rwanda About 1 million people died in 3 weeks, and it was up close and personal. It wasn't even like the Holocaust. It wasn't like our wars. It was with machetes, with knives, with pistols, with rape and murder. It was kids killing adults. It was a kind of the nightmare of the last part of the 20th century, with more to come. So we went to Memorial. The Memorial was in a church, many churches actually, but the church we went to, there were 2,000 skeletons divided into children's bones, adult bones, and then they had a few totally put together humans. And it was, you know, it blasted our minds, I guess. It did something to us. And we went to a former memorial, which they had just opened, actually, that week, which included the Turkish genocide of the Armenians, about 700,000 people, which still has not been acknowledged, actually despite the attempts of Congress to pass an ordinance, something about it. It had the Holocaust in Germany, and it had their own genocide. And the woman who was showing us around, a gorgeous woman of about 20, who was telling us, showed us a picture, and we suddenly realized that she was showing us a picture of herself as a 13-year-old girl, and she was talking in this little voice about seeing her mother, her father, her sisters killed, raped, and she was in a corner talking to some person. Also, when we walked around, we said we were psychiatrists, psychologists, and everybody wanted us to help. I mean, there was always about their sister or their brother or their aunt, not themselves. But in fact, it was like people walking around with glazed eyes and with black humor. The only thing I could think of was it's sort of like Jungian analysts sometimes wandering around not knowing where they're going, except, you know, this was a whole other world. So that's one part of the adventure. Okay, back to, we then went to the gorillas. Gorillas, we, you know, should have been kind of good, clean fun. We went up, they're in a mountain at Uganda and Congo and Rwanda intersection. And the troops of gorillas hang out in this mountain, and you have to find them. And although the guides kind of know where they're headed, they move quite far in a night or in a weekend or whatever, or a day. So, you know, 4 hours later, climbing up this mountain with lots of, with four guides with guns, because around that time the whole group had been kidnapped in the Congo looking for chimps. So there was them, and there was a lot of young kind of athletes, the way I saw them. And then there was, and Pilar, who's a phenomenal hiker and a superwoman, in every way. She is my partner, so. And then there was me, and the guide, after 4 hours of climbing through this bamboo forest, recognized that I was a potential casualty, let's say. So he kept his arm on my shoulder somewhere. I did fine. And the purpose of mentioning that is that suddenly, maybe this is 5.5 hours in of climbing, we got to a clearing where there was where the troop was, and I kind of made some eye contact with this gorgeous, magnificent beast, the silverback gorilla. If you've never seen one, it's one of the great sights. And the guy was saying, well, this guy has just taken over the troop, and next minute it is charging me. And it was like death. I mean, this was 700 pounds, And I thought, some part of my mind thought, well, he recognizes a really another strong male in the group. Now, that was, that was a, sort of a death thing. And in fact, he knocked me aside slightly because he wasn't aiming at me, but his shoulder, I felt the hair on his arm, it was very hot, and a little bit of skin, and that was enough to kind of propel me against the guide. He was after, however, the little infants that had been born to the mother whose mate had just been chased or killed. So that's another classic scapegoating. So somehow, although in both those instances, every scapegoating event is covered by a story, a myth. You know, the Rwandan is about colonialism, or the Belgians, or the difference, the tribal war forever. All true, but it's still, you know, the killing of one group because of the way another group looks and acts. In the gorilla story, it's, you know, child abuse. It's right in humans, and we saw it in its primitive sense. We are mammals. It obviously started before humans. So we went back to South Africa and began to, you know, lecture on scapegoating. It was quite an experience, the whole trip. I think the reason I began that way is to somehow underline the importance of this. If in the scapegoating is, as you'll hear a lot from Pilar, began with child sacrifice, and most anthropologists think it is the first human, you might call it celebration or ceremony, and that from it comes our whole ability to build culture. And that hopefully will become clearer, because it's a very strange statement. But it got out of hand in the 20th century. And in the 20th century, the events I've talked about and others, millions and millions and millions of people died around basic scapegoating maneuvers. And that's not including the wars which surrounded it. So, and I think everybody intuitively knows in this century that if that kind of thing happens again in a country that's not the Sudan where it's going on now, it's going to really end us. I mean, because we have weapons of mass destruction. It just can't be. You can't have that mechanism, which we use to develop group behaviors and effective groups to continue to operate. So I work a lot with leadership and leaders, and young leaders are very conscious of this, that somehow it's around how do you make do with other people when you hate them, when you have revenge things going, how do you change that? And I don't think anyone has really plumbed the answer to that question. But I think that's why it's a really critical question of for us and for psychology. I'm a Jungian analyst. Pilar is a Jungian analyst. This is the kind of subject you would have thought Jung would have gotten interested in. He didn't. And part of that is because scapegoating is about groups. It is the archetype of the group. Individual scapegoating it doesn't exist. I mean, individuals get affected by scapegoating, but it is not a individual process. It is always a group process. And Jung was not fond of groups. Frankly, he didn't know how to work with groups. But in particular, he went to Nazi Germany to help out in developing the mental health system there when it was nascent. And he's written about it and some of you may know more than I do about it, but he was really used, and he left in disgrace because people felt he was a traitor. what he was doing. And it was connected to Freud and the World Psychotherapy Conference, and he had anti-Semitic remarks going on, and you know, some of them were part of his culture, some of them were misinterpreted, and some of them were from him. By the time he finished that episode in his life, he would say that groups are bad. Groups are, stay away from groups. If you think about, you know, the Jewell and Jungian theory, which is individuation, the way he says it, it's about if the individuated person has to leave his group, has to leave his collective, and find himself or herself through wanderings, through something, and then that's, and then, dot, dot, dot. Jung doesn't say come back. There's only one place he talks about that very early and gives something back to the community. He really feels that that is the essence of human development. And with that kind of feeling, groups are, you know, always kind of a negative shadow on that path. Well, and obviously Jung is so sophisticated and brilliant that it's well said and it's interesting. But many of his students, who would have been our analysts, perhaps yours, took that really quite concretely. And one of my analysts was Joseph Henderson, who's a marvelous theorist, marvelous person, a dear man, who's, I think, died at 103. And I don't know if he's come here to talk, but ever. But anyway, you may know of him. He said to me, and he said to a group at San Francisco, well, there's only been one good group, and that's the group that worked with Diderot to make his encyclopedia. And I remember doing what you did. I remember, you know, kind of laughing when I was working with him one-to-one. I didn't laugh. I remember thinking, well, transference goes just so far. You know, this is a stupid remark, and it comes right from his work with Jung. Until very recently, trying to teach about groups. Remember, scapegoating is all about groups. In a Jung Institute, or talk about it, was really not interesting to people. I mean, I think some of that has changed. I know that Sam Kimballs was here, and he was one of our students. There's a lot of attempt to bring group work, usually not thought of seriously, because it's like the group isn't, we know so much about individuals. Jungian theory does enough, perhaps it just doesn't do much with groups. But happily, there is another theorist who I think is almost like, thinks like Jung. And how many of you know or have heard of Ralph Gerard? Is there anyone?
René
Girard. Okay, we have one René Girard present. So René Girard, who I learned about in the end of my book, and I was looking at my book Up from Scapegoating, and I put in a sentence about him. It was just to acknowledge that, you know, I read. But he's remarkable. We have his reference up there. He's about in his mid-80s, Girard, and he's at Stanford. He's retired, and I spent a day listening to 10 hours of tapes. The Canadian Broadcasting Company did oral interviews, and it's marvelous. He's written 11 books that are all about scapegoating in one form or another, but not from the perspective we'll be talking about. He was an anthropologist, he's a philosopher, he's very big the way Jung was, but his knowledge of human psychology is limited. But let me just follow a little, because we all owe a debt to him, and he's an increasingly important man, actually. What he said was that humans, as they developed early, the anthropology, this is, you know, 10,000 years ago or something, could not get along. I mean, he has a theory about it. He calls it mimesis. He says that people get have desires, have competition, have angers, and when they're in a group, which you have to be to develop or to live, really, that amplifies and multiplies, and there's eventually a group explosion. And that's the way early society worked. And then someone figured out this remarkable invention, which was, if you sacrifice something very important, you give it a kind of halo around it, you will bring a group together. So the first ceremonies, he's dealing with documented work, some of which you'll hear about, was around child sacrifice. Or it could have been sacrifice, it was around weakness or age, but children seem to be the essence of it. And that cohered society, and that after a while, the sin of that, the great sin of that, got to people, made them feel guilty. And so they created a story. They created an obfuscation of what they'd done, and they created a story. And the story usually related to, the person was a god. And so they had sacrificed the god wanted to be sacrificed, something of that sort. He says that myths, these cherished myths with Jungian, it's our bread and butter, are around the cover of that basic sin. So, for example, and this doesn't come from him, this comes from someone who had heard of him, that we were reading about literature, so in a tape of Oedipus. You all know the Oedipus myth, and the play from Sophocles, which was the center of Freud's psychology, huge impact on Jung as well. This king married his mother, slept with his mother, killed his father. But that's not the actual story. The actual story, and the way Sophocles starts his play, is there was a plague in Thebes. And someone had to be killed, sacrificed, in order to stop that plague. So there we are by this time society has invented gods. The gods make the plagues, and there needs to be a sacrifice to the gods. You know, what else is new? That's around, that's something very common. And for a big plague, you get a big guy, and that's what Oedipus was. And it was quite conscious in that when you read that play and you look at that play, you see that that is what the story is. He is the sacrifice of the four Thebes to get rid of their plague. And there's a story. Why else? How can you sacrifice a king? Well, he's got to do something big. And that myth develops. So that's René Girard. And he goes one step further, which is really interesting, and I kind of lose him a little in terms of where does he believe. He starts talking about Christianity and Jesus. Now, Jesus is the archetypal scapegoat. He died, and he died for us, right? That's the message. He said that, and some of the earlier Hebrew prophets, was the first time when someone said, I am not, essentially uncovering the secret. You can't say that you're killing me for any other reason than to keep your house in order. I will take your sins. And from now on, you know about this. You can't get away with hiding it behind myths. And humans have to do better. So and that was 2,000 years ago. And Girard says, you know, we haven't gone very far, but for me, he says, that's a long, you know, it's a short time. Humans have a long time to develop. So Shakespeare says, Brutus says, Cassius says, Brutus, it is not in our stars, but in ourselves that we mistake responsibility, something like that, which is that same statement, that you can't look to the stars, you've got to look to ourselves. The essence of scapegoating is that we will not look to ourselves in a group. So, you know, with that intro, it seems to me that I can go on to talk about just scapegoating, so you know what I'm talking about. So it began, I've been obsessed by scapegoating since I've been born, it seems to me. I mean, I've worked on it forever. I was born in 1937, so I was raised during the beginning of the Holocaust, of the Nazi formulation of the Jews as a scapegoat so that their nation could purify themselves and grow big and strong and conquer the world, basically. And the World War II, which, you know, all of that was sort of not known to me, but gradually began to, in my childhood, I began to get clearer and clearer what happened in the war and then in the camps. And my family was involved in helping some of the Jewish refugees to get to Israel, and then really quite directly involved with having Israel a nation which would take those people in. So that was what I got as a child. Now, did that have to do with scapegoating? Of course, it's totally inside me. But what actually got me involved with scapegoating was that little kid. That little kid is me. He's thin and scrawny and small and really smart. And that is a prescription at 7 years old to be scapegoated, to be bullied, as someone said. And I, you know, helpless little me, supposedly, would get, go to a schoolyard, my schoolyard, and would get hit on. Not sexually, but, you know, beaten up. Lots of people have had that experience in one way or another. Men, and at that point, no, women were never bullied. Now we know that, you know, that went on just wasn't quite as dramatic. Anyway, I get beaten up, and no, adults don't help that. If you're a parent, you know this. Your kids come to you and you say something. It doesn't connect. What connected for me was a plan, which was that, and I can remember this, that the next time a group, a bullying group came at me, or a representative of a bullying group, I would charge, and I would think in my mind, I am going to kill you. And I went for the eyes, I went for the throat, and I went for the genitals. And that led me directly to the principal's office. And the principal said, the principal was a woman that said, well, boys will be boys, and fight like a man. Implicitly saying I wasn't fighting like a man. That went past me like an arrow going past, I don't know what, why that, but I can remember that. Actually, it's from a meditative thing, like you let thoughts go by you, that disappeared, because I could already see its effect. People were not bullying me as much, and they stopped bullying me. I mean, some kids got hurt, and they picked someone else rather than have your testicle ripped, you know. So that worked, and that worked till I was about 13. So here I am now, little 13-year-old boy, still small, still scrawny, still smart, and in high school. God, pubescent in high school. High school was tough. The high school had guns. It had drugs. Our president was taken away as for dealing heroin. Not the place for that, my first idea of how to get rid of me as a scapegoat. And I invented a really good one, which I now think about as the enforcer. It wasn't, you know, that's a basketball term now in part. You get a big guy to help you. I just found big guys. And I really went after friends that were giant, in my mind, you know, sort of big. My best friend was 6 feet. At that, you know, I was probably 4'8". And it was quite conscious, and I tried to do what mafia guys do, which was have some people around so I'd be protected. And that worked well. And it lasted maybe 4 or 5 years. I grew up. No one was trying to fight anymore. And being smart has always been an advantage. And actually, I've not been scapegoated in any real way since then. But there's something about that connection and the childhood really made me interested in this problem, and it also made me interested in and finally led to writing novels about revenge, which I want you to buy. They're really good, and they've helped me because the issue of revenge and scapegoating. That's the problem, that when you escape, this is not a simple fight that you can sort of shake hands. When you're scapegoated, this is a group against you. And I know in any audience that I've given this talk to, there's usually 10% of people who have this direct experience. You get fired because of some reason in a small town, and you can't get a job, and people look at you strangely, and your whole world collapses. People who are scapegoats, real scapegoats, as we've learned from this new bullying thing that's, thank God, kind of moving through our school systems, and the hazing, which actually the novel started from a hazing suicide in this town that I just couldn't believe, and I worked on it a little, and it was so painful, I had to figure out a way to deal with this when you have no ability to get revenge. Which is the way, of course, parents feel. So revenge lasts. Revenge is an obsessive, horrible, endless feeling. It isn't something that, you know, we're asked to somehow get past it. And it's a wonderful thing to get past it, except the human doesn't get past it. It is a major spiritual growth to try. But it's a lot to ask. And so these things last for your lifetime, generations, and centuries, if you're talking about subgroups. So revenge becomes something that's very tied up with scapegoat. And I won't talk too much more about that, but it is critical. So here is the biblical definition, great invention. In front of the Lord, Aaron must place all the people's sins unto the goat, and send the goat out into the wilderness, place of Azazel, which is a kind of devil's place, where there is no God. So the reason why that's an event, actually one goat was killed, as usual, but this one was sent out and not killed. So instead of the human sacrifice, this is the invention of the animal sacrifice. I mean, bad for the animal and the goats, really good for the humans, which is, you know, the way humans have progressed to dominate our planet. So this goat, there's a lot of issues about it. It's taboo. You can't touch it. You can't go after it. It can't come back. All the issues of real scapegoating. And, you know, the desert is a difficult place to be, and so on. So here's our modern definition, Pilar and I. Three parts. The first is the scapegoat is a person, subgroup, collective, idea, object, made to bear the anxious blame for others in their place. So the new part of this is it's not a person only. It can be a subgroup. It can be an idea. Dear, I mean, that's the human brilliance. You can take an idea and you can say, you know, you may not talk about Mohammed, or you may not say certain things about Marx or anti-Marx. So I mean, you know, we have them right, evolution or progress. Objects. I mean, you can. The Christianity castrated all these statues. I mean, that major artistic horror scapegoating a male genitals. And actually, scapegoating works of art, produced 1,000 years ago, let's say, at the Greeks. So all that fits into this paradigm of scapegoating. Here's the strange one for Jungians. The process of scapegoating represents the group's push towards wholeness. Scapegoating is a negative term in our lexicon, but the process is not negative. The process is the human archetype of what we do in groups. If you are in a group, count on scapegoating being around. It is always there. Tom and Pilar and I were talking about a little bit about how to deal with it. There are ways to deal with it, but there are always kind of lesser ways of scapegoating in a way. And the push to wholeness is very much like the individual. Individual moves towards wholeness. It's got its problem because it's got a shadow in Jungian terms. And that shadow has to be integrated. But before you can integrate it, you've got to at least recognize it, push it out a little, maybe push it out completely, and you know, then you deal with a part person. But you're trying to make things more whole. If a group has, if you've been in Japan, which is, 96% the same genetic world, and you add a foreigner or a stranger, they don't really want that. They're used to being able to do things as a total homogeneous group and do it very well. So, you know, that's the experience when you go there if you have to work, because, you know, you become a natural scapegoat. It's not around a negative, but if you can't, they can't work in that system. I mean, I'm right now stereotyping them. But when you have a job to do and someone keeps getting in the way, you try to get rid of them if you're a group. Now, the leader might say, well, maybe that person is adding something. Nevertheless, it's that process, not a bad process. And society moves by deciding who they want in their group, hopefully including more and more, but not necessarily. The third part of the definition is talking about the scapegoat embodies the transformational, creative, and or destructive potential within the group. If you're in a group that is scapegoating, and all group scapegoating, and you're a leader, you recognize that when a group is after someone, they're representing something really important. And you may want to try to protect them. I mean, if you're a smart, scrawny kid who's getting, which was me, you don't want, if you're Harvard, you don't want, and I'm not Steve Jobs, you don't want to get rid of Steve Jobs. That lost them billions of dollars. In this city, you have, you know, your Microsoft genius, also left Harvard. These are all ways of saying those really creative guys and girls can't stay in the nice group in which you're supposed to take courses and get A's, B's or something. They want to do something different. So the creative, the artistic, is always the scapegoat. It's always at the edge of the group. It's always being pushed down. There are also a lot of negative people who are being scapegoated. But the creative people are always there. So that's part of the scapegoating process. This is trying to talk a lot about positive scapegoating, because if you're a child in a difficult family and you've got some smarts, you leave if you can do it, you know. So the dynamics. This is a subject, again, all to its own. I was rereading my book, and I was describing what amounts to a kind of drug trip. Pilar and I asked to consult to lots of groups, and sometimes consult to groups to just find out what the process is. And the way you go about that is entering the group mind. And there is a group mind. The group is a collective which has a definite consciousness. But it requires kind of pushing past your individual ego boundary, like you would with a dream. And when you're in that place, you can see the processes. I mean, good people, good leaders, good followers know those processes anyway. But you, that's what you have to do. You have to leave yourself, your ego behind and move into the group. So if you're in a group, that issue that you're being forced to move out of your ego because you've got to let go of something in order to be a good group member. You can't be totally present and just want everything you want. You know, you're not a, can't be a 3-year-old infant. So the group doesn't like the anxiety that it feels, individuals and the group. And you can feel the anxiety. And then starts this really strange process where you begin to identify, jockey for the position of not being the scapegoat. In most groups, the visual is very important. So race, gender, age, youth, those are all easy scapegoats. He can't be in the group because, you know, she is too sexy to be in this group, it'll mess things up. Those kinds of things. In more sophisticated groups, it can be competition. This guy is going to be better than me. This woman is going to, I mean, all that kind of energy. And so at some, and this is kind of consolidating a really complicated process, you eventually end up by identifying a scapegoat. And there's usually a battle, you know, to get out of it and eventually expelling that scapegoat. Of course, as soon as you do that, you get back to the initial part of the heal. Maybe you're less anxious, maybe not. Maybe now you're really anxious because there's no one to pick on. And I know everybody's felt that. And then someone else begins to be identified and the process goes on. Again, not necessarily a bad process. The group could be happier, and if you begin to look at what happens to scapegoats, most of the time, scapegoats don't do well. So they become victims. For those of you who are therapists, they come to our offices. Most patients who are in trouble feel like victims, can give you scapegoating stories about family, work, national traumas. So that's what usually happens. But there's another two groups. One are the messiahs of the world. Jesus. We'll get to some more. But basically, if you can figure out, if the moment you're pushed out of a group, you enter this special status of maybe you're a god. How did I get here? You know, how did I do this? And some of those people actually do something incredible because they leave the ordinary group and the horizontal thinking and so on, and they move to another place. And I'll mention that in a moment more. The revenge seeker, that's a big one, again, because some people scapegoated, hold the anger, and end up massacring kids. I mean, you know, that Adam Lanza, whatever else was going on, he wanted revenge. And I don't even know if anybody did anything bad to him, but he sure didn't belong. He had a mental illness. He was in trouble. He was ignored. That much we know. And there's going to be lots more. And he wanted to get even. And he wanted to, he showed his anger where it probably belonged, you know, to kids. Because that was a trauma for him. And if any of you have been in that situation, it is really painful. With any luck, you don't have to go and do what he did. But there's revenge behind all those massacres. And revenge and scapegoating are the same, part of the same cycle. Just a little bit about the world. We're talking about, I said it's a very large subject. Hunger Games is a scapegoating story. If you've seen it, it's about a part of the world that's isolated and is used to feed the central part. It's a story of a little girl who's also scapegoated, and then she gets revenge. She comes back. So it's a, and these are very common stories. They really move us. The Scarlet Letter is, of course, the classic one, classic American one. It's a story about, okay, the most common scapegoat in the world are women. I mean, I was collecting newspapers about this because I'm starting a website called Dr. Scapegoat, and I want to see who would be scapegoated. And, you know, it's always women, always. Women, it's hard to believe it, actually, the amount of negativity thrown at women, the amount of the inability of women to do things in many cultures, including our own. And it's usually about their sexuality, and that's what, of course, Hawthorne captured, that Hester was a sexual woman, not good. Get rid of her. Competitive. It's not just the men, it's the women. It's the mothers who clitorectomize. You know, it's all that kind of world. The scapegoats that I talked about being messianic, so Gandhi. Gandhi was killed by his own group, by the Hindu people, because he wanted to allow the Muslims to be part of India. And that, you know, he was a prophet in some ways, but he, like so many prophets, was put to death around a really good attempt, which, you know, has led to things. Kennedy, another sacrificed messianic figure, he represented sexuality, brilliance, youth, risk-taking, promiscuity, heroism. You know, and this guy, I remember, he just encapsulated a lot of things. Catholicism, in a country that hadn't elected a president that wasn't Protestant. A lot of the things that about scapegoating were his. And he didn't get killed by someone who was really after that. But if you begin to get groups, there's a representative who comes in, and the forces against him, as in Martin Luther King, as in Robert Kennedy, that whole period, was a trying to stop change. You know, so they represented change. It was a strong group trying to stop change. This last thing is more important. The amount of people dying around the scapegoating process just escalated, and the Holocaust was one of them. Apartheid, people were made into what Erickson calls subspecies. Blacks were subspecies. We gave a talk like this, both of us, in South Africa, in a town where the Afrikaners had come 2.5 centuries ago, had found little black people. They weren't quite bush people. They had that gene in their blood. They intermarried with them, which was essentially forced rape. And so, we were giving this talk on scapegoating to this modern day town, Prince Albert, which was half and half, genetically related, basically, the white Afrikaners, the colored, coloreds is what they call them. I'm not sure what they call themselves. And they really understood this talk. I mean, Americans have trouble with there was just so clear, you know, the history. I think that collective scapegoating process is the one that we really have to watch, because it is a terrifying process. We were just in New York, and I saw this slide put up by the atheist.org. And it's really, you know, it's part of this talk in some way. It's Merry Christmas, you know, keep the merry, dump the myth. It's a difficult myth to deal with when you've got this scapegoat in the center of it. No matter how wonderful the words, it is an example of the human need to find a victim. And that's the better part of it. I actually like this. I think, you know, atheists are one of the groups that have a hard time speaking up. Find some other code word to talk about your lack of belief of God if you're in America. So, Okay, very briefly, because this is not about things you can do, but there are a lot of things going on, education about it, mainly in the bullying and hazing world. Laws get passed. Group consultants basically deal with scapegoating as an interpretation. That is, you come into a group, it's having troubles. It's always that process that's getting in the way. And you somehow have to figure out how to say it without angering the dominant people. And Pilar and I have been, when we're really right, we have trouble getting S back, because it is not easy for a group that's dominant. We saw this in South America in particular. The women rose up. The men had cornered the market. This was, and it was all very exciting, but everybody, including the women, sort of wanted it to go back to where it was. It's hard to be heroines in the face of, you know, a system that's functioning. And the legal responses, this is Milosevic, who led massacres in Srebrenica. This last one I think is important again. The artist, a scapegoat, an agent of revenge. And I think a lot of Picasso and Guernica, because Picasso was basically fled Spain in the Civil War, never went back, and lived with that, you know, this genius, and was asked to paint Guernica, actually, I think, by Rockefeller. And he did this painting, which just is all about revenge. It's all about the evils of that society. It was like a way to say, you know, fuck you to Franco. That's basically what it was, this because he had faced this himself, and he painted this masterpiece, which was a way of trying to, of really more successful than the, you know, it lasts, is a way of saying it.
What is the name of that piece?
Guernica. Yeah. It's a little town in Spain. Pardon me?
Where does the painting live?
Oh, the painting has a long history. Some of it is it's in various forms, but some of it's in the Modern Museum of Art. But it's interesting. It's perhaps the most famous painting of the 20th century. So it's Guernica. Picasso's Guernica. I should have. So, just wind this up, because I must. I should. Another adventure. Pilar and I are off in Thailand and in Chiang Mai, which is north, and we're looking for adventure. And we hear about a trip to the border of Burma, which you can't go into at that point, and it had, you know, elephants, and you had to go to boats, and it was a great trip. It was a great trip, very interesting through these jungles, and ending at a village where there were these long necks, so-called long necks. Does anybody ever hear the long necks? This is just a picture of the village there. The kind of primitive village. This was probably 2000, something. Okay, so here's a picture of a young woman. Look at her neck. And another young woman. So it's not surprising that women like the Chinese, binding feet, are often straight scapegoated, but there is myth around it. The myth here was that if you were born, well, let's see, the myth is really around fear, the plague, which is a tiger. Tigers in that jungle, and they come every once in a while, and they take a child or a human away, often a child. So to counteract the tiger, if you were born on a Wednesday of a full moon, and you were a woman, a little girl, you were nominated to be a long neck. And so at the age of 2, you got your first gold ring around your neck, and that lasted up for your life. The effect of it was to make the collarbone descend and atrophy all the muscles that hold up the head, this, you know, a fifth of our body, on the neck. So they couldn't hold up the neck without this collar of gold. Okay, here's beautiful Pilar with a very long neck, and this young woman with a long neck. So I revisited this. I mean, this is straight scapegoating, right? I mean, it's a horror. If you've been in Amsterdam and you look, I just remember being in a restaurant and looking across the street, and there was this framed window, and there was a prostitute sitting in it, all dressed up. And that's, you know, advertising. But it was also quite beautiful in its way. She was very dressed up, and it was, you know, a dark street with this bright light, if you've seen this. It's the way these kids were. They were sitting on the porches like they were princesses, except their faces weren't very happy, and their lives were pretty awful. They were always in chronic pain. And when I checked the internet about this, when I was going to decide to use this series, and there had been a woman fashion consultant who'd come, and she said, well, you know, these are very beautiful. Women have always tried to get these long necks, and this is a way of getting the long. She was aware that there was some trouble. She said you could, you know, you really could take them off and get your muscles back. Unlikely. And she also said that they were now a product. These women were being used. They were being sent to Europe, like Pocahontas was sent to London, I guess, a couple hundred years ago by the American government, I guess. And they were getting money. The village was getting money. So this is a modern example. This is going on, and there's already sort of a cover growing around it, very much like making feet of Chinese small because they're somehow sexually interesting, there must be a myth about it. I at some point this kind of horror grows, and I can't investigate it. But you can imagine how much resistance there was in China to stopping the binding of feet, and there will be resistance here. So this now leads us back into the beginnings and of sacrifice. Okay, well, I will introduce you all. Yeah, well.
Paul, I really like what Arthur said about human sacrifice. I'm going to get over here. Because it is one of the most commonplace historically, and believe it or not, it's going on right now. So I'm going to try to take you from the beauty of the Peruvian human sacrifice adventure of the Inca days down to the unbelievable decadence and perversion of today. And that's the part that probably won't get on the tape. But you should know, for example, that the hiding of it is unreal. For example, Stonehenge. Everybody says it's all for the astronomy and so on, but actually, if they look at all the areas, they're the human remains at the right places, the way the Druids killed them, because the foundation of places are filled with bodies. We create buildings, like we create culture, like Arthur was saying, by killing people. And it's very interesting because ask yourselves, what do people get when they're in a human sacrifice experience? If any of you have ever killed an animal or been there when an animal was sacrificed, and what you feel is so intense, just think of a person. Think of the intermingling with that human being that is being killed. Think of the guilt. Think of the pleasure that it's not you. I mean, all of that's going on, the surrender to this. I mean, it's just an unbelievable. When I started this topic, I was all interested in this piece that I'm going to tell you about, which is actually an initiation. Nobody kills anybody, but people get killed in it. They just die. Because it's a consequence of what they do in the initiation. But I got totally involved in the topic. It's been one of the great adventures, really learning about it. So let me start with Peru. First of all, I don't have a map of Peru, so I drew something on the board that's worse than the kindergarten would do it, but it tells you. Peru is enormous, and you can look down the center of it. One side of it is the Pacific Ocean, it's all coast. The center is the Andes, these peaks that go 20, 25,000 feet. I mean, they're enormous. Then you have the jungle, which we were talking about, which is the Amazon jungle, which still has tribes that have not been discovered. And then you have, I'm showing you the countries that border it, Ecuador in the north, Colombia, Brazil, and Chile in the south, and Bolivia. And I tell you especially about Bolivia and Chile because they come into the picture later on. Okay, I'm going to go back to Inca days. The Inca Empire got a lot of its power. It took over most of Latin America. But it didn't just do it militarily. It did it through a system of reciprocity and favors and offerings to each other. So the horizon of mountains, all those peaks, were the political center. I mean, they could tell everything that was happening by just looking at the horizon. And let me give you an aside right now. This is an aside. I think one of the important evils that go on is that we don't look at our culture. You have to understand that all the people I will talk about are embedded in a world, and in that world, they think they're doing the right thing. Even if they feel guilty, they still feel that they're doing the right thing. And I think that's the greatest evil, that we don't look at how we're doing the same thing. People don't have consciousness around how they're part of a culture. So, because I want to remind you, the Peruvians are very, very, the Andeans are incredibly illiterate, and they're very concrete. Very concrete. So when I get to that part later on, that will make sense. So anyway, the Inca Empire depended on favors. And the most important offerings were humans. So like Cusco, which is the center of the empire, has like 450-something huacas, adoration places, sanctuaries. And these sanctuaries all vary in terms of the hierarchy of value that they have, so that they would, the religion and politics are very intermingled, so that they would have all these sacrifices, and they were mostly children. The way it would work is different villages from all over the countries would send children, the more beautiful children, to the center, to Cusco. And these children would then be treated very royally. They would be handled beautifully. I mean, these children really died thinking that this was a good thing for them. Well, you never know. You know, these are the chronicles that say this. And they would be anything from 100 to 1,000 a year. And if you were a lower, say, cacique, you would have a beautiful child, and then the Inca would receive it, or you might get a better post, or you would actually automatically. Or there would be, even within the IUs, the family centers, in any conflicts or anything would all be settled by these offerings and gifts. And since everything is about reciprocity, I mean, how do you hold an empire that big? You don't do it by having a lot of warriors. I mean, where do you get the warriors? They're all these people. The Spaniards, which are my people, when we conquered Peru, we eliminated all their gods, and we tried to impose the Catholic faith, which, of course, didn't completely fulfill it. But they didn't do that. The Inca Empire, the Incas would have the gods from everywhere, and they would have their huacas. I'm going to call them huacas because it's easier for me. So one major reason to have these children sacrificed was to have all these favors and offerings for the foundations of places. And nowadays, when they have all the equipment to climb these high mountains, they have found many, many, many of them in small kind of ruins scattered here and there where they find these bodies of these children. And they don't look unhappy. They don't look like anybody has really killed them. They look like they have peacefully accepted their fate. So Arthur and I, one more thing. How can I put it? The way they look at the cosmos has three levels. There is the inner world, and the inner world is all of the waterfalls and the mines and things that go into the world. Then there's the middle level, which is everything that is rivers, that is seeable, trees, everything else. And then there's the upper level. The upper level is God, Mary, Jesus. So you can see how they begin to try to integrate. And you can move through all of these levels by crossing them. And this will become clearer when I take you through our initiation. They have a whole set of priesthood. I'm trying to move fast because of this half hour you told me. It's done something to me. There's the priest. I'm going to take you to the story before I move on. Arthur and I went to Cusco to this initiation. Now, when you get initiated to a priesthood in their terms, you go through many, 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 many levels, many rituals. You learn how to make these despachos where you have the coca leaves and the different objects, and they're actually mandalas that you fold in and so on. That's level one. Then at every level, you have a guide, and then you have to do all these sacrifices and offerings. And as you go higher and higher, you go to the top of the mountains where you spend 3 days alone, and then at one point your guide tells you that you're all completed and you can do this by yourself, and you are now in charge of your relationship to the star, which is your spirit. But it's very interesting, since they have this idea of integration and reciprocity, they can do this with foreigners. So when the last Inca will appear, it can be a foreigner. So they have a way, they included us in this initiation ritual. And it began in Cusco. So we went to the church. I'm going to just pace you through as they give you a feeling of it. We went through the church and to the cathedral, and we went through a mass. And we saw the image of the God of the earthquakes, who is a black crucified God. And, you go through, you look at the different saints and so on. And the idea is, if you feel joyful and good, you can keep going. If you got frightened, you should stop. And we had one person who started to feel fear, and they tried to talk him through it, and it didn't work. So he left the group. We were a small group, 6-7 people. Then after that, we started the Royal Highway of the Inca. You go from Cusco all the way to Machu Picchu. Is a long way, and there's some unbelievable ruins in this whole process. Has anybody been in Peru, or am I just... Some people have, okay. So the ruins are enormous, and the boulders that connect them are, they're huge, and there's no way to understand how they get them there because they didn't have the wheel. And they are connected like this. Nothing, there's no cement, nothing. So they have all of these incredible, incredible buildings. And what we would do is we would go to each one of them, find the spot. We were guided by this man who was half Indian and half Spanish, who had become a professor at the university in Cusco, who, when he, as an aside, he was going to go on a scholarship to Cusco, to Oxford University, and he had a vision. And the vision told him that he had to be a leader, a shaman for his people. So he stayed, and he did a whole of this training to be a priest, shaman type. And he was our leader throughout this whole thing. So we went through each of the ruins for miles and miles and miles, and we would do things like, one would be for the wind. So we would take in the wind, and then we would, the hucha is the energy that you have to release, is the bad energy. And a lot of what they talk about is the stomach. A lot of it is you eat. You're always eating through your stomach energy. So we did it through the wind, and we did it through the sun, and we went through many places. And when we got to Machu Picchu, we went through the waterways, because and eventually, I'll tell you more about that. Aside again, I'm talking all in riddles. For the Andean people to survive, they need water. So the snow-capped mountains are the most important ones, that this most of the energy, the apus, the gods, the most important gods, are in the high mountain peaks, because that's where the water comes, and the river and lagoons. So anything to do with water and mountains is their whole horizon of religion and political understanding, and all the families, the ayus, the regions, everything is organized, keeping that in mind, and they know exactly where everything is. They have lines of great connection, and they have connected that whole immense world. So we were taken, and that spine that goes from Cusco to Machu Picchu is the most holy place. So all the ruins on the side of that are the most holy. So our initiation as foreigners was to make us the Maiku India, Inca. The Maiku Inca is a very high-level priest. I mean, it's like he jumped us many levels because we were healers. That would be like level 4 going on to level 5. Level 5 does not really exist. We were aiming to be level 5. If you become level 5, you become a healer that can heal anybody, anytime, perfectly incredible. You're an incredible healer. Level 6, you're just a beam of light. And there's 2 more levels. The point is you can recognize all these levels, and at the end of time being whenever that happens, they will all come together and they will recognize each other. And then, of course, we can all go on. They all went to the seashore, right? We were actually doing the initiation to be this level 5. And so we were going through all the ruins. Sometimes when you sit down on these stones, you realize that they're perfectly shaped to put your body into them so that you can exchange energy with them. When you go through the arches, if you're sensitive, by then we were very sensitive, you can feel the transformations of energy. And then we went to Machu Picchu, where we did a number. We were on the human sacrifice tablets they have there. And then we went to Huayna Picchu. Huayna Picchu is connected to Machu Picchu by a very thin bit of land. And so it's much taller. And we went all the way down to a cave that's filled with meteors. And has snakes drawings in it to again exchange energy. You know, I'm trying to condense a huge amount of material for you, and I don't know how to give you all the cosmology and all the levels fast anyway, but I'm trying. And then we went all the way up the mountain of Huayna Picchu, which at the top has a passageway through the rocks. And when you're going through that, you're exchanging your gender. So you go in as a man and you come out as a woman. And then you have to do this incredible climb on some very smooth rock, which is at the very, very top. And I think if we weren't feeling so holy by then, we wouldn't be crazy enough to try it. But there we were, at one with the highest, right? That was just the beginning. Because after that, when you do that and you're in the next step of initiation for all the people that are doing this kind of thing, that wasn't us, but the people that are getting initiated to these levels of higher level of apprenticeship to be priests, is you go to Coyoriti. Coyoriti is the peak is Copacabamba. It's a, how can I put it? It's a glacier. I mean, when you look at it, we started at 17,000 feet, and you're looking way up. I mean, you know? Okay, so you start at 17,000 feet, and we had to do a very long drive to get there. And one of the things that happened in the drive, because the roads in the Andes are not only very circuitous and very dangerous, but what they do is sometimes they put boulders on them. So the idea is if there's an accident, then the highway has been fed blood so that there won't be any more accidents because the highway is not satisfied. There's a lot of blood stuff going on. So we actually at one point were almost sideways, remember, of the road because we were supposed to be feeding blood to the highway. But fortunately, we went though. Somebody else probably did. I don't know. And when they have a like a little church at the bottom, And now begins the ceremony. Now these people, and at the very center of the ceremony, there are going to be 70,000 people up there in the middle of nowhere. But for, at this point, you have the celadores, which are the people that organize things, and they punish you. You know, they punish the people who don't behave well. But most people behave really, really well because they're on pilgrimage, and many of them haven't had any water or any food for 3 days. They can drink some water from a holy lagoon, but that's, you know, they're not in great shape. The important people are the ukukus. The ukukus are the half bear, half divine, half human people. That's three halves. And the ukukus come from a tradition there of they're supposed to be enormous, and in the Andes, these special characters that have big, huge eyes, and they dance, and they crunch the stars in their fists. So in the folklore of the Andes, these are very powerful creatures in their mythology. So the ukukus actually in these ceremonies are just regular people. And they're young men between 18, 25, who are the best lot of all the villages. And they come dressed in a tunic with a black top on it, and they have a special cap that they wear. And for a long time before that, they're composers of music, and they're into little folklore dances, and they have been doing this already for a while, and they have been getting prepared, and they have to do all kinds of offerings and abstinences and so on. So they walk in file, and they have a whip that represents lightning. So if you don't behave yourself, they whip you three times. By the way, the pilgrims themselves that are coming also do a lot of these being whipped and so on. You know, it's a lot of penitence and belief. So what they do is they set up, every so often there's a cross, a Christian cross, and underneath, and sitting on top of rocks, because for them stones, rocks is really the traditional. The cross is it's borrowed from, well, by then it's integrated, but it's the Catholic. And you begin, and you go there, 15 of them. So you begin to climb, and when you get to one of these crosses, you do what they do, which is you kneel down, and you exchange a stone, and you have to take your hat off. One time I forgot to take my hat off, and I got whipped, which was not, didn't hurt that much, but it was like, whoa. And then you do that as you go up. Maybe let me see. I'm trying to show you. This is what the Peruvians look like. This is just in the village. That's a relative and more Indians. That's Machu Picchu. That is Arthur looking at Machu Picchu. As we came in through the gate of the sun because we were walking. So we look down on Machu Picchu, and that peak behind it is Huayna Picchu, the one we climbed to do that. All the caves be above and above. That's me in one of the sacrificial rocks, one of the altars. Altars are very interesting. A human being is an altar. I mean, people who get sacrificed are altars because they're the ones that represent the other world. And when they get killed, they're in charge of making sure that the crops grow, that the waters come, that wealth is good for the community, that the llamas keep reproducing and all of that. I think we tend to think of an altar like a table or the mass or, you know, something like that. But if you look at festivals, you look at the American flag, that's an altar. It's a crossing place. They're all crossing places. You get static altars, you get moving altars, people who dance in Africa as a moving altar. A human sacrifice is an altar to the other world. That was one of our stops. Okay, Coyoriti. The way Coyoriti happened was the story behind it. On top, after you get to the very top of the mountain and you've been walking, I don't know how many thousand feet up by then, there is like a church made of wood. It's a large room, really. And on the back of it, there's a large wall that's covered with a kind of glass, and emblazoned on it is a Christ. I mean, that's the miracle, right? And the story is that this little boy was tending to his yamas with his brother, and he had some trouble with the brother, and the brother left, and he went to try to get back home and not meet his brother, and he went over the mountains, and he bumped into another little boy who was dressed in these beautiful clothes and was a beautiful creature, and they played, and they jumped, and they danced, and so on. So this little boy, Mariano, developed the habit of meeting with this wondrous child, and the boy would bring food and all these good things. And then one day, the wondrous child, was his clothes that had always been perfect were broken. So Mariano went to get the cloth and went into the town to get the cloth, and discovered that the cloth was the only cloth you could get if you were working with the saints in the church. So the bishop became aware of this. So he got the story, and they all came back to look at what was going on with this child. And they did see him in the distance, this precious child. And then when they approached, he disappeared, and then there was, from the tree was hanging like a cross, Christ, the blood, and so that's how the miracle happened. And also there was a piece of wood that is more for the Indians. So they sent this back to Spain and some pieces, but then this image became emblazoned in the rock. And you know, it actually looks like it. It's kind of interesting. So once you go up all these levels, these are the ukukus. And they're on their knees. You know, they're about to begin their journey. Just the beginning of it. These are the little groups of musical people that always arrive at the crosses that meet you as you're going up the mountain. This is just to show you, I actually got a little mixed in, but the amount of confusion there is between the local stuff and the Spanish imposition. For example, we were told that in the big processions of Corpus Christi, they would sneak under the dresses of the saints that were being paraded right through the square of Cusco, little pieces of their own mummies. They're always trying somehow to balance these two worlds. And it's very complicated for them. But somehow they do it. I don't know how they've done it over the centuries. Here's another one. There's a lot of mockery when they can dance. The Spaniards are made to look kind of, you can see it there, it's like making fun. Okay, this is a Moran ukuku dancing in some other area, getting all dressed up in a pre the Coyote Festival. Here they are again. I'm trying to show you that these are just guys. And they're so sincere. Okay, now see, when you get to the mountains, you begin to see that there are lines of people coming from everywhere. The pilgrims are coming from all the villages all over the place. And you see them like little lines that appear like that in the sky. And they collect for 3 days, about 70,000 of them. There they're going. That's at the bottom, before they leave. The little church where they do their first prayers. The ukukus are going now. See their whips? And they have their hats. That's an example of one of the crosses. Another cross. See, we're going up. This is one of our people. She got really sick from the altitude. Soroche is pretty awful. She was fainting. If you're a pilgrim and you die in Coyoriti, in the area during the festival, you're buried there. You become one of the altars yourself. I don't know what they would have done with her. I mean, you're really up there on your own. And there are all these other people who are involved in their own thing. And Peruvians, on a one-to-one, are incredibly sweet and generous. They're very good people. They're also incredibly violent, but in a different way. but not they really believe in reciprocity and integration, so that they would help. People immediately ran over to help her. That's another cross. It's a little higher up. Now you can see some of the peaks in the back. Can you see the snow back there? And you can see now it's even further back up the hill. The ceremonies, there are so many processions. More processions, more up there. I mean, they have 3 days of drumming. They're drumming day and night, day and night, day and night. We had a little tent, and so we could come in and out. There are no sanitary facilities or anything. You just make do. That's that church I told you about, where at the end of it is the Lord of Coyoriti emblazoned on the rock. And this is when they're beginning to get ready to do the last step of the initiation. Okay, let's say. What the Ukukus do is they, at 2 in the morning, they start up the mountain. And in connection with the notion that they're this divine bear gods, and they're going to destroy this other monster, the Kaikufu, who is a monster with big eyes that go in circles and has a big beard, and they have to fight the monster, that's one thing. But also they spend like the whole night dancing and jumping and doing everything they can to stay in movement, and they're very agile. But what happens is that many of them fall. Some years it's 6. That's how they die. And the other thing is that if you stop, you freeze. So you never stop moving. So some of them die because they have to stop. They're exhausted and they can't do any more, so they die. But on the whole, the people who die, and they know this is going to happen, and when they come down in at dawn, they carry blocks of ice on their back. And the idea is that they're carrying their stars, the stars, because the light of the sun reflects on the ice, and it's like they're bringing down the stars. And I think I mentioned before that when you get to a place in your initiation that you're really powerful, you have a star spirit. So this is part of the same principle. But you can see the relatives sitting, looking up, and you can see the anguish in their faces because, you know, they never know. Sometimes there are 20 or 25 of these young men up there, and they don't know who's coming back. They don't know if their son, brother, or somebody's coming back or not. And then when they do return, the ones that die, die, and they become gods, because the whole idea is you become an altar to the other world. You're now a deity for real, and you will be helping people and the whole region, the whole world, actually, to be more fertile in some way. And then they go and take the eyes to the church. This made Arthur crazy, because he felt that all that ritual was always being given to the Catholic Church. It really offended his sense of how these people should be able to have the integrity of their own beliefs and how their minds had been affected by having been conquered by the Spaniards. And that's pretty much it. Then they disperse over... They have many processions and festivals and dances, and eventually they go back to their own villages. And the soul repeated. And the solstice is a time for festivals where these things happen. Now, this is actually kind of beautiful. The setting is gorgeous. The principles of human sacrifice of the Incas had a real reason for happening. I mean, they were trying to maintain peace and order in a huge empire with no hassles. That's the way they settled trouble with each other. But all of that has been translated to the present in very similar and totally dissimilar ways. I mean, the area is filled with human sacrifices. There was one, and they're done by shamans. So, for example, there's the marijuana. Let me give you one example. In the 1980s, there was in Chile, which is at the southern border of Peru, there was an earthquake and three tsunamis. So the people found themselves surrounded in a hilltop. So they got the shaman woman to do a human sacrifice, which is what you do. You have to appease the gods. You can't just let it be. This has to stop. And you have to feed the gods. So they got a little boy whose mother happened to be traveling elsewhere that day to get some food, because they take people who are not protected at that point. And they cut him up. They cut his arms and legs so that, poor kid, he was screaming. Yes, you can imagine, huge pain. They chopped him up, and then the torso they put on a spike. If you think about it, the spike is like a rock. So they keep trying to repeat the same pattern. If you talk to Marijuana, which Patrick Tierney did in one of his explorations over there, she said, big need requires big sacrifice. She actually was put in prison for a little while on this one. And this happens to the shamans. Periodically, they get picked up and they get put in prison. But then they're released. And if you ask like the PEEP in Peru, which is our FBI, they're going on all the time. You know, this, you could see these people disappeared, all these women. It happens a lot to servant girls. In those faraway areas. And for example, in Lake Titicaca, which is, I don't know if you know, it's about 15,000 feet plus, and it's right at the border of Bolivia, there is a very large enclave of drug lords. They have a lot of cocaine there, and it's very well protected. And they have a lot of human sacrifices in the area. The drug lords are the patrons, and they want to keep the money and the good stuff going so that they get somebody to kill the person. They have to be present to watch it, though I'm sure that's not always true. But that's the way it's supposed to be. So they take somebody, they pick them up, they take them to the mountain. It's always some peak or some waterway, because the beliefs are consistent now as they were in the past. And they will dismember them. A lot of beheadings. For example, going back to antiquity, you probably have all heard of the Nazca lines. In Nazca.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.